offers solutions to keep the symphony thriving in his latest piece. In Minnesota today, 10 legislators have called for new leadership at the Minnesota Orchestra. They sent a letter to the Minnesota Orchestral Association Board of Directors. They're holding their annual meeting today, and they sent the letter 14 months after stalled contract talks led to a lockout of the musicians. We have two guests with us this hour to talk about symphonies in the country, and particularly in Milwaukee and in Minnesota. Tom Strini is with us in our studios in Milwaukee, writes about music, dance, theater, visual art, and cinema in Milwaukee at his own arts blog. Thank you, Tom, for being with us again.
I'm always glad to be here, Kathleen.
Nice to have you here. Joining us by phone is Eric Nielsen. He serves as chair of the governing members of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Eric, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you very much.
Well, we got troubles right here in Milwaukee and in Minnesota. Do we have troubles in other cities around the country when it comes to symphonies staying afloat? Tom?
Sure. Even the mighty Philadelphia Orchestra had to declare bankruptcy.
Really?
Not that long ago. Orchestras in smaller cities have closed in a few cases. The Nashville Symphony got into big, big trouble. These things happen a lot. And lest we think, oh, gee, the good old days when they were all solvent and so on, not true. Because in doing a little research now, just so we could have this chat here today, I was surveying literature on this, and one of the pieces I ran across was a 1969 article in Time magazine bemoaning the demise of the American Symphony Orchestra. And I'm old enough to remember, even before that, people were saying that. And I think if you go back to the 19th century, you'll see hand-wringing articles about the end of culture from that era, too. The fact is, symphony orchestras, not only here, but in Europe, since day one, have been hothouse flowers. They survive in Europe on big state subsidies. And before that, they survived on aristocratic largesse. And in this country, they have been largely funded by wealthy patrons, to a lesser extent with ticket revenues. Mm-hmm. And during a sort of aberrant period in American life in the 60s, 70s, they got considerable public funding. That's pretty much gone now. And that's part of the problem. But part of the problem is symphony orchestras, with a very few exceptions, and those are the ones with enormous endowments, like the Boston Symphony, for example, are always in trouble. Hmm. And let's not forget that the Milwaukee Symphony only dates to 1959. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of places like Nashville sort of in that range, or Oakland, California, places like that, didn't have orchestras. It's a relatively recent development in a place like this. And so you can look at it one way and say, oh, gee, it's yet another crisis, and how are we going to fix this? Or you could say, in a way, we're in a golden age, because there's a huge surplus of great players. I mean, the orchestra in this town
is very, very good.
It is absolutely world class, and we're getting it for $17 million a year. Of course, going down to $15 million, or under $16 million. But let's not get too gloom and doom, because we've been hearing gloom and doom for a long, long time, and the orchestra's still here.
But in Minneapolis, it's gloom and doom because you're not getting much music at all from your orchestra, are you, Eric?
Well, at least on the Minneapolis side of the river.
Right.
But I would like to add to what Tom has said, and first of all, Tom, good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And I agree with everything you've just said. I embrace it wholeheartedly, and I would even go a step further and comment that if one reads the biographies of great 19th century and even earlier, back to Bach's time, if you read the biographies of great composers and great performers, with a couple of standout exceptions like Mendelssohn, who was born into wealth and a performer like Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, who had a great impresario, the theme, so to speak, throughout all these biographies is that these people were scratching to make a living. So, you know, again, this is nothing new that classical musicians have had to struggle for to make a living.
So. I think of Brahms hearing from his publisher saying, can't you write more of those Hungarian dances? They're flying off the shelf for a four hands arrangement.
All right.
But you're not, what's the problem in Minnesota? We still have a symphony playing, but you don't, do you?
Well, we do with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, but that's, you know, it's a chamber orchestra. It's not a symphony, although there is substantial overlap in repertoire. And the SPCO does play in 10 venues throughout the Twin Cities, not just on the St. Paul side of the river. But with respect to the Minnesota Orchestra, sadly, I think the whole thing has just run off the rails. And you know, the people I talk to, musicians, management, people out in the community, are all wringing their hands as to how we get this train wreck cleared and the whole show back on the road. And no one seems to have a way out as we speak. A couple of observations about this, if I could.
Yes.
I could, and they overlap with Tom's great introduction. The first is that the lockout here in Minnesota has been marked by this incredible vitriol, and it runs both ways, but it's particularly aimed at management and at the board. And I just find it, frankly, embarrassing. Some of the things that I've heard attributed to musicians and to their union. And I think this has been had a very negative consequence. And so what started out as essentially a financial dispute, if you will, has turned into a visceral personality mm-hmm. disorder. And that's really hard to overcome. There's just such bad blood that's been spilled here and over the whole thing. And unfortunately, from my perspective, because I should add that although I'm chair of the governing members of the SPCO, which is not to be confused with the board of directors, the governing members is a group of about 140, 150 people in the community who commit to a certain level of giving each year and participate in on sort of a consultative basis with the management of the orchestra, but we're not responsible in the same way that board members are. But by way of that perspective, and the fact that I have three sisters who are professional violinists, one in the Boston Pops, another in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra itself, mm-hmm. And another sister in the Minnesota Opera.
Oh my!
I have that in a very close family sort of way that the musician's perspective. I myself have studied violin all my life. I play two full recitals every year. I know what it takes. I really know what it takes mm-hmm. to serve in that capacity. And there aren't that many people around on the face of the globe who can play at that level. So I get that. I understand it. I sympathize with the musicians. I know how hard they work from age, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, and on to the present. But I also live in a world, the world of business and law and sort of what you might say that the practical world. I most of my social network and professional network lies outside the music world and even outside the arts world. And I understand this community well. I understand people's attitudes. And when I take all that into account, I just find the musician's position, generally speaking, is just completely unrealistic, and I much of what I read on the musician's part is just misconstrues reality.
Mm. And that seems to be quite different than the way musicians are reacting in Milwaukee, isn't it, Tom?
The situation in Milwaukee is really anomalous in orchestra labor relations all around the country.
Mm.
Almost every orchestra that's gotten into trouble, and I can think of Houston, I can think of Philadelphia, San Francisco for a little while is a well-oiled machine that San Francisco Symphony is. Even they had a strike not too long ago. And almost all the orchestras that are in serious trouble have had labor problems at the same time the recession hit. So you go to the musicians and you say, we can't pay you what we paid you last
right.
year. Will you go along with that? And most of us don't like that very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a labor dispute, and pretty soon they're calling each other names. And it's very easy to get into a sort of power to the people mentality and say, these poor musicians. It is not easy to play an instrument at that level, and you have to maintain it, and you've spent 20 years learning how to do it in the first place, and you feel underappreciated, you feel dissed, you know, and it's very easy for musicians to lash out in that way, especially if they don't really know what's going on, and very often they don't. Because they haven't sat on committees mm-hmm. in the orchestra. They don't look at the books. Nobody explains anything to them. And meanwhile, many of these orchestra PR arms are saying, oh, gee, everything's rosy. And then 6 weeks later, they say, oh, gee, we're going out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads to a lot of whiplash. And it also leads to mystery as to motivation, and when there's mystery about another person's motivation, it's very easy for your imagination to start running wild and to imagine evil intent back at the back of everything. The Milwaukee Symphony has sidestepped a lot of that, because when Steve Ovitzky was executive director about a good 10, 15 years ago now, he put in place a system in which members of the orchestra, maybe five or six of them, will sit on every board committee. They know exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They know exactly what the situation
mm-hmm.
is. And so there's no mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows what everybody else knows. And everybody else knows what everybody else is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that has led to an extraordinarily reasonable relationship between management and the board.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of union people say the problem with that is you lie down and die, and you won't fight for your constituency. And in fact, MSO players have given up an awful lot.
Yeah.
Seven concessionary contracts
wow.
in 11
Seven.
Years. Seven. And very often those contracts have been reopened. In other words, you're promised this level in 3 years. You know, that typically they come in 3 or 5 year steps, where in 3 years you're going to get this pay. And very often management has had to come back and say, you know how we said we were going to get this much? Well, you're not.
Right.
And but because they understand the circumstances, they haven't fallen into this sort of, you know, public name calling, which is very typical in
mm-hmm.
these kinds of disputes. And I think now everybody understands that everybody's intentions are honorable and always have been. Do the musicians like what's going on? No, they
I'm
don't.
Sure they don't.
But they understand it.
Yeah.
And the thing is about this particular contract that's coming up is they aren't getting cut again. What they're doing is they're reducing their number of full-time positions through attrition. Nobody's even getting fired. Now, all that being said, another contrast between Minnesota and here is the Minnesota budget is over $30 million, has been historically. MSO has peaked at about $17.5 million. MSO musicians get about half of what Minnesota Orchestra players get. About 60,000 versus 130,000 in Minnesota. And, of course, there are many players who make more than that because of, you know, individual bump-ups for whatever now whatever reason. But I'm talking to contract minimums here. And yet, Milwaukee is a very, very good orchestra indeed. And yet, there's no vitriol going back and forth publicly between players and management.
Minnesota seems to pay more in a lot of professions, I found out by doing this talk show. Let me ask both of you, let's talk about sports for a moment and get on one of my high horses, because I like baseball, Tom knows that, and I like soccer, I like sports. And it was a struggle to get a tax, certainly, to keep the Brewers in town. But I'm wondering, why is it so difficult, why would it be so difficult to put an eensy-beensy little tax on all of us, you know, in a metro area? It is, because we all enjoy the symphony and the theater and chamber orchestra, and it's so hard and has been for centuries to have this survive, and it's so important to our soul's well-being. Why can't we go that route? Has Minnesota thought about that at all, Eric? Just
well,
let's tax
yeah,
us.
I'd like to approach that. You've hit kind of a sore spot with me, because I also live in a family of absolutely crazy sports fans. And
right.
Not too long ago, I sat through a two-hour card game with my family and another family, and it was nonstop sports talk at about the NFL, and I was amazed that those people could sustain a conversation that intensity about any subject for that long.
I know. I live with a group of people like that.
The whole time I was thinking, gosh, there is so much time and money and effort spent on professional sports, mm-hmm. and college sports, high school sports in this country. And here you got, you know, the arts off to the side, and classical music is a tiny subset of that.
Right.
You know, can't we do better? But I think that the answer isn't so much to look to public subsidies as it is to try to figure out how we increase demand. Because ultimately, you know, you can apply taxes to the problem, but if you don't fill these concert halls, if you don't draw people to the art form, it's going to, you know, continue to be a thing in the corner. And I think given today's technologies, given the way communication works today, we can truly create a golden age for classical music. We just have to be innovative and a little imaginative about it. So my approach would be let's expand the demand for this. And I think one sign of hope in all of this is that I think in conservatories across the country, I don't know what's happening in Europe and elsewhere, but certainly in this country and at the, you know, major music school, university music schools, there is now a concerted effort to develop a sense of entrepreneurship among performing majors. And I think that's going to turn the tide here. I personally sit on an advisory council at Minnesota University of Minnesota School of Music, and the director there, David Myers, is doing a fantastic job of getting out on the cutting edge of this whole entrepreneurial movement within the performance of classical music. And we meet a couple times a year, and there are faculty members and graduate students and undergraduate students who speak, and I'm just amazed at their creativity and how they're putting together personal portfolios. I mean, these are, you know, classically trained and highly proficient performers,
mm-hmm.
and they're developing all kinds of fascinating concepts for getting out there in the community and making a living at what they do,
mm-hmm.
Without compromising the art form.
How about a little tax, Tom?
I'm sorry, what was that?
A little tax. How about a little tax for all of us?
A little tax, well, good luck. Right now, the atmosphere, I think this is going to change, but just generally, politically, nobody wants to be taxed for everything, for anything, but everybody wants all the wonderful things that taxes
right.
bring. I think that's not realistic at the moment. I think that could change.
Yeah.
5 or 6 years, the atmosphere could be very different, and I think I'm seeing signs of that. I would like to see... And actually, I wrote about this in the blog not too long ago. Right in town here, the Milwaukee Bucks would really like to have a brand new arena.
Right.
To replace the Bradley Center, which was built in 1986 and still looks pretty shiny and new to me. But they feel like they need, you know, all the bells and whistles that every other NBA city has. And not that I've toured them, but apparently they do. And so they want to tax the metro area some little bitty tax to cover a big chunk of this. I'm not interested in the NBA. I really personally don't care if the Bucks stay or go, but I can see that it's a nice civic ornament, and it's good for PR, and it's probably worth a little bit of public investment to compete. That's the way the world is, you know. Otherwise, some millionaire in some other Tulsa or some places will snap them up. And but what I proposed was, this is going to be an uphill fight, even to get that arena.
It sure is.
And so why not broaden the base a little bit and say, yeah, a little bitty piece of that is going to go to fund Milwaukee Symphony, Florentine Opera, Skylight Opera, just the big institutions where it could help to stabilize them over a long period of time. And I think it would actually help when these sports franchises want to dip into the public trough to pay for their playgrounds. And I think it would help if that became a piece of the equation. It would broaden the base a little bit. And there actually was some movement on that, but it's going to the art museum and to the zoo was the plan for that. And I guess because if you're thinking in terms of marketing, it's easier to say these are capital things, these are big shiny buildings, and the Milwaukee Symphony say is just people. You can't hang a plaque on a person. So I think that might be the thinking there. But I would encourage arts leaders to sort of look at riding coattails for some of the big sports institutions. The other part of that is the Milwaukee Brewers, when they play their 81 games here, and I go to a lot of them. And by the way, I scored a goal in my soccer game last night, and we won.
Congratulations. And he's not a youngster anymore, we may add.
But sports is just a part of your life. It's in your face all the time.
Right.
And what was the first thing that got cut when the Milwaukee Symphony got into trouble? I happen to know that they cut $400,000 out of their marketing budget over the past few years. That is not good.
Right.
You need to be in the public's face in a big way. And now there are marketing avenues where it doesn't cost you $30,000 to produce a TV commercial. You can produce a TV commercial for $2,000 now. And I think that a much more vigorous, well-funded, sophisticated marketing effort where there's just a presence, there's just always a buzz. The other thing is, as an organization, you must have a story to tell all the time. When in the 90s, the story to tell was, hey, we have a really dashing young 30-something music director coming in, and Andreas Delfs. Then they had, you know, that terrible old hall we've been playing in since 1963 or whenever it was, and it's all threadbare and the acoustics are lousy. We're remaking that hall, and it's going to be really nice, and everybody's going to love it. Oh, we're going to be the first American orchestra to tour Cuba since Castro took over. We have a story to tell. That was 1999. They haven't had a story to tell since then. Orchestra plays Beethoven is not a story. It's, you know, you want Man Bites Dog, right? And you have to come up with some storyline that captures the imagination of the public, and that might mean you have to do something a little different. But that is really, really important.
Let's welcome phone calls. I have a feeling we're going to have quite a few of them for both of our guests. We're looking at what's happening with symphonies, but it's happening with arts groups too. It's just that it's really a problem and very noticeable in Minneapolis right now, where the symphony is not performing in Minneapolis. This morning, 10 legislators called for new leadership at the Minnesota Orchestra. They're saying that it has been terribly mismanaged. Let me find out what the letter said here. It said that the current administration is destroying the Minnesota Orchestra and calling for the resignations of the CEO and the past chairman. In Milwaukee, there's been, I'm sure you've noticed, a lot of writing about what's happening with the Milwaukee Symphony, not the animosity between management and players, but that they are short money and they need, they're saying, $5 million over the next few weeks, or they will be forced to close. So what's the way forward for Minnesota, for Milwaukee, for other symphonies, chamber music, orchestras all over the country? Here is our phone number. We'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. What about the makeup of audiences? Are they old? Do we need to be grooming younger people now? Do we need people who have a lot of money? And there are a lot of people who are in the top 1%. Do they just, we need to nudge them to give more money because they are the people who, after all, are going to fund our symphonies? Do symphonies need to be playing a different kind of music? Do we need more pops concerts to grow the audiences? We welcome your thoughts on this. Lines are completely open for you at this very moment, so give us your thoughts. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our guests this hour are talking about symphonies and the problems that symphonies in Milwaukee and Minnesota are facing. And we're welcoming phone calls. Eric Nelson is chair of the governing members of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Seems like everybody in his family is playing an instrument and playing it beautifully. Tom Strini is writing about music, dance, theater, visual art, and cinema at his own arts blog. And let's go to Terry in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Terry.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I wish I was calling with some silver bullet solution to some of the problems you're discussing. My wife and I, although we don't have season tickets to the symphony, we do maintain season tickets to three of the theaters in Milwaukee, and I think there's some parallels here. Both she and I are at about 62 years of age, and it's frequent when we attend the theater that we're often among the youngest people in the audience, and that's really sad. I don't think that waiting for some rich entrepreneur, some wealthy person to donate a bushel basket full of $100 bills or, you know, some pizzazzy commercial is going to do it. I think that both symphony and theater, they've got to start marketing themselves with younger people. I don't see the younger people in the theaters I'm attending. And that's frightening. Unless you fill up those seats, it's just not going to survive.
Eric, you want to respond?
Yes, Terry, I agree with you completely. And I find myself, when I'm attending a concert, a typical concert, I look around and I think when juxtaposed to how we live our lives in this day and age, this is such a stilted presentation format. I mean, here we are expected to sit perfectly still in our seats for, you know, an hour and a half, not make a sound, not applaud after an allegro movement, and we expect that 20-somethings and 30-something people are going to be attracted to this kind of experience. I mean, it's just completely anachronistic for our times, and we have to rethink, I think, every aspect of the experience without compromising the integrity of the music, and I think that can be accomplished. We have to look at seating configuration, for example. We have to think of the venues and the possibility for different types of venue. The whole program you know, why is it that I have to necessarily attend or show up at the outset and stay for the duration? Why can't I leave after the first piece if I don't like what's left on the program, or arrive late as long as I'm not interrupting the performance? Why do we not clap between movements? I mean, this is a vestige, and I've tried to research and see what the, you know, what the origins of that custom are, and it has no, I can find no musical basis for this tradition of not clapping. And, you know, we've all been to a concert where someone experiences the public humiliation of clapping between movements.
Yes, yes.
I mean, they're never going to show up again. So we need to rethink, I believe, rethink the entire format to try to draw a younger audience. It's just unrealistic to expect that's going to happen the way
we're... Do we need to rethink what we're performing, Tom? Do we need more pops concerts?
It depends on what you mean by a pops concert, which is a very, it's sort of a moving target as to what exactly a pops concert is and what it ought to be. Is it like classics? Is it, you know, the William Tell Overture and stuff like that? Or is it a sort of serious look at maybe the history of rock and roll? I can imagine a great symphonic choral Beach Boys concert. Which, as far as I know, doesn't exist, probably because royalties are insanely high on that stuff. But I think something could be worked out along those lines. And, you know, the thing is, in Milwaukee anyway, they're doing pretty good at the box office. That's not the part that's broken. The part that's broken is the donations part of it. And you could say the business model, because it's too expensive to employ 82 people, but you know, I and as for the concert experience itself, I don't know that we want people to feel obliged at some point to applaud between movements. And the worst part of that would be required polite applause between movements, which requires an audience to applaud 12 or 13 or 15 times over the course of an evening. And guess what? They get tired when they have to do that. I could see getting rid of tails and all that, you know, and letting people just, you know, just show up in black shirts. That's fine, you know, to reduce that a little bit. And I can see a little bit more multimedia presentation if it really helps. And you say, oh, let's have the conductor turn around and talk about the piece. That's great if your conductor is a charismatic
right.
guy who
no.
knows how to talk and
right.
has something to say. If he doesn't, let's not just require that because, gee, it's some marketing person thought that would that would work. The other thing is, when, you know, I get my tickets free, but I look on that and it's like $75 to hear 2 hours of music every week.
Yeah, can't
maybe
afford it, right?
It's too much. And that's I think, more than anything, keeps younger people out. All that being said, at MSO concerts, maybe it's because I'm getting older and older, but the audiences are looking younger and younger to me. And there are lots of young people, you know, peppered among the gray heads in the orchestra right now. And our caller talked about theater. And, you know, there's a very good parallel, I think, with like APT out in Spring Green, American Players Theater.
Mm-hmm.
What's their stock and trade?
Shakespeare.
And yet, they just pack them in out mm-hmm. there. And you're talking, you know, you just say, well, you know, orchestras mainly play 19th century European music. That's really mainly what they do. Well, they play like 16th century English theater. And yet, you go there, and people are totally enthralled, and people show up in large numbers, and you got to drive 90 miles to get there.
And walk up a big hill. Right.
So if you play your cards right, you can make this thing work. But I think the idea that if we only play Beethoven, if we play anything other than Beethoven, nobody's going to come, is an idea that probably had currency 30, 40 years ago. But I think the audiences are much more open to newer music than they used to be. And MSO played a Michael Ippolito piece not too long ago. Beautiful, atmospheric sort of thing. And you can't really hum the tunes or anything like that, but people loved it. And even this audience in this provincial outpost in Milwaukee is really pretty open these days. And so I think there is broader room for more lively repertoire, and especially if you can bring in composers and make a personality out of them in your market, that would help a lot.
Here's an email. This one goes to you, Eric, from Jim in Osceola. When the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra members were asked to take a pay cut, did the CEO also take a pay cut?
Well, the CEO had been working for free for quite a while. I think that Debbie West had been working without pay. And that was his contribution to the effort, part of his contribution.
Okay. Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Pops concerts, I think, are kind of a poor idea. Any orchestra can play a Pops concert. You don't need to have the high level of training and artistic ability you have in the Minneapolis Symphony, for example, to do a Pops concert, and I don't think you'll really bring a lot of new people into that. I personally think the problem, as it can be in government, is you've got some of the wrong people in the administration right now. It used to be, for example, Northwest Airlines. You knew they'd have a strike every couple of years because you had people in management that just were itching to do that.
Management where? The Minnesota Orchestra? What management are you talking about?
Pardon?
What management are you referencing?
Management for example, in the Minneapolis Symphony.
Okay. Eric, what do you say to that?
Well, I find it suspect, actually. That, and I am hugely skeptical about, you know, the sort of the broad criticism of management, because it seems that across the country, every time there's an orchestra faces financial straits, it's blamed on incompetent management, and I just think that's too simple of an explanation. It goes way beyond that. I don't think actually that. What we're dealing with here, whether it's in Milwaukee or Minnesota, is ultimately a financial problem. It's a cultural problem, and it's what Tom alluded to, Tom the guest alluded to at the outset, that classical music draws very little attention compared to all the other distractions that are available to us. And you know, again, if you look at professional sports and the huge amounts of money that commands in our culture, there's money out there. There's plenty of money. Even in hard times, there's plenty of money. It just, you know, it's a matter of supply and demand, and the demand for this art form isn't sufficient to support the musicians at the levels they would like.
Thanks very much, Tom, for your call. Our phone number, we have lines open right now, is 800-486-8655. We're talking about financial troubles facing symphony orchestras in the Midwest, particularly because our guests are talking about Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra in need of $5 million. Minnesota Orchestral Association had a meeting today, their board of directors, and the legislators in legislature in Minnesota are saying that things really have to happen here to change, because the symphony hasn't played there for a long time. And we're talking about what it is that will allow that symphony to be performing once again, why it is they're facing 14 months of stalled contract talks and a lockout of the musicians of that orchestra. How tenuous is Milwaukee's financial situation for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra? Where are orchestras thriving? We should ask that question, and can we learn anything from them? We'll take more phone calls, too. Now all of you decided to call in. You're late. I don't know what the heck. But we'll get to as many of you as we can in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Kurt in Elgin, Illinois, our next caller. Hi, Kurt.
Hi there. I just had two quick comments. One was related to the to getting a younger audience. I had a suggestion that perhaps there might be a couple of nights a week or weekends or something like that when students would have significantly reduced ticket prices, even if they showed up an hour, 2 hours before the performance, $15, $25 or something like that. When I was graduate student, they had that at the New York Philharmonic, that you could come and get a ticket just with your student ID. And the second one was related to a previous comment regarding management. And my suggestion or my thought about that was that one of the responsibilities of management, it seems to me, is if there are cultural shifts, to figure out how the orchestra or any organization should respond to those shifts, not just the sort of fiscal management of things. So if we need a younger demographic, which I agree with that completely, then that would seem to be management's responsibility, not the musician's responsibility, who will play whatever you know, significant pieces are provided to them. So that's all I had to say.
All right, thank you so much, Kurt. Tom?
It is the musician's responsibility to help put people in the seats. You can't anymore just practice your instrument and go home and keep your head down otherwise. And it's the same in the newspaper business. You have to be out there as a person who is entrepreneurial and think that way. So, for example, in the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra right now, you have a cadre of young people who are on Facebook all the time. They're talking about what the orchestra is doing. They're getting their friends to retweet their comments. They are out there putting themselves out there as members of the orchestra who are proud of what they do. And every single person in every single orchestra in America ought to be doing that. And, about this particular caller, the Milwaukee Symphony has always had student rush, $11.
Oh, my.
And that's not just for the nosebleed seats. That's for the
really?
Best seat available.
Wow.
1 hour before the concert.
Ooh.
With student ID. So all you kids at home, no, it's a wonderful thing. And I teach part-time at UWM, and I always send my students down for that. And they love it. Once
That's
they get
great.
There, they have a blast. But, and I want to jump back one thing to the last caller, too, who was saying, oh, Pops concerts, that's beneath a symphony orchestra. No, it's not. Milwaukee Symphony sold 98% of capacity over the past weekend at their Holiday Pops.
Uh-huh.
And I was there. I got to tell you, it was a lot of fun. And they made a ton of money because they had no stars. And, you know, the when you hear an orchestra that good play that music, it's really something. You know, and it's not just a bunch of hacks sawing away. I mean, they are really playing it. And I remember years and years ago when Frank Allman first showed up as concertmaster, and the orchestra was playing a really snoozy Pops program with, like, the associate conductor. And you could just see everybody just slumping in their seats. They were not having a good time. So they weren't having a good time. We weren't having a good time. And then Frank is playing in some cheesy arrangement of Rodgers and Hammerstein tunes, and there's a big violin solo in Younger Than Springtime. You know that song?
Oh, sure.
And he played that like it was the most important thing he'd Aww. Ever played in his life, and it was just like the whole orchestra lifted up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was bored, too. And I heard that, and I thought, you know what? When you step in between those white lines to play a game, you give it everything you got. And I don't care what the score is. And that's the way this orchestra thinks now. They play with enormous vigor at these Pops concerts. And it's a wonderful experience to be in the room with them.
Let's thank you so much for your call. Catherine in Three Lakes. Hi.
Hello. What a wonderful program. I'm just so delighted to hear this problem being discussed. My contribution is that I think one of the keys to growing an audience is to make sure we have a strong music program in our schools. The Milwaukee Symphony has come up here, actually, to our little town and to Rhinelander, and they were here this fall, and oh my goodness, they sounded so wonderful. Mm. But I had a chance to talk to a couple of the musicians a few years ago and ask them how they got started. They started learning their instruments in school, in a good school band or orchestra program. And the same is true up here. And I think it's so important that young people hear more than one kind of music. They have their iPods and all the rest, and they tend to all listen to the same stuff. And we need to expose them to all the different kinds of ways you can play an instrument and what you can do with it. So mm-hmm. I'm a big advocate for music programs in the schools.
Thanks, Catherine. It sounds, Eric, like Minnesota has done a lot of outreach as well to various parts of the state.
Yes, it has, as has the Chamber Orchestra. And I think that has become a general practice among orchestras across the country, this community outreach that you didn't see a generation ago. But to Catherine's point, I'd underscore education, but I'd also underscore mere exposure. And part of this is based on just personal experience. I mean, growing up in a musical household, I had proper technical instruction, but the vast majority of my exposure to music was casual. You know, it was always playing in our house. And no one sat down and said, this is Brahms, and this is a symphony written in, sonata form, and, all that. My dad put a record on the old, phonograph, and would stand in the middle of the living room and conduct it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big smile on his face. And
kids would have committed me if I'd done that.
But my point is that music is something that ought to be accessible to everybody. And unfortunately, in our culture, in this country in particular, it's viewed as something obscure and hard to understand and that you have to be an expert to appreciate it.
Sophisticated.
And I liken it to the ocean. I mean, you don't have to be an oceanographer or a scuba diver or an expert sailor to enjoy the ocean.
Thank you very much for the call. We want to move to one more call. We're running short on time. At least one. Piera, is it from Milwaukee? Hi.
Hi. I'm a 12-year-old middle schooler, whatever. I'm a seventh grader.
Uh-huh.
And I just recently went to the Legend of Zelda Symphony in Milwaukee. And there was a lot of, I think the concert was based more towards like middle-aged, younger people, and a lot of people went, and it was a great show. I want to go to so many more, and I think that if there was more concerts more based towards middle-aged people and maybe had something to do with either like young pop culture, it maybe it would attract more people.
Pierre, do you play an instrument?
Yes, I play French horn.
Oh, wonderful. All right. Thank you. Thanks, Piera.
Mm-hmm.
Tell all
thank
your
you.
Friends. Talk it up for sure. And let's go to Keith. Can you do this in 20 seconds, Keith? Green Bay. Hi.
Okay. My wife was a teacher for many years, and she had a lesson plan called Food for the Mind, and she was teaching second through maybe fourth grade. And this was a regular part of her curriculum. She would play a piece of classical music, not really tell the kids a lot about it because they probably wouldn't absorb it, but just who wrote it, maybe when.
Uh-huh.
And then have the kids, while they were listening to it, either write something about how they felt or draw pictures with the second graders. But they were exposed to it. It's not just the kids who play instruments. It's everyone in that class, because otherwise we're just growing a generation of worker bees.
Thank you, Keith, so much for your call. Tom, thank you for being with us. Eric, thank you for joining us by phone from Minnesota. Thank you both.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks. And leave messages on our Facebook page. We'd like to hear what you think about this. What's the way forward for Milwaukee and for Minnesota? Tom Strini, our guest, writes about music on his own blog right now. And Eric Nilsson, who is a governing member of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Thanks to KP Whaley and Cynthia Schuster.